do we need this? Like, would it make our life? No, is the answer to that no?
No, because this takes JSON and tries to make it into something that it's not, right? Like, it's like, let's take JSON and make it like a structured, defined, typed, like, property. Like, it's like that exists. It's called XML. Oh.
So we've all been on those pen tests before, right? Where we're just banging our head into the external attack surface of a company for what feels like an eternity. And then when you finally get inside the network, it's like open freaking season. There are accessible shares everywhere. CVs are popping left and right. There's seemingly no controls at all on what ports can or cannot be accessed. Too many companies are neglecting their internal network security, and that's why ThreatLocker came up with this product, Network Control, which makes it super easy to control what kind of ports are exposed on a given host, whether that be a user machine or a server. The thing I like the most about Network Control is that it understands far more than just the IP layer. You can allocate specific controls to keywords or tags, and then use those to manage access from different machines, regardless of whether they change IPs or not. So if you're looking to shore up your internal network, make sure you check out Network Control by ThreatLocker. All right, let's go back to the show. All righty, my man. We are rolling on this beautiful fall day. How's it going?
Oh, yeah. Good. How about you?
Pretty good, man. The size of the to-do list is growing and growing. I'm going to Grenoble next week for Grey Hacks, and I'm going to be presenting on some Kaido stuff out there. Nice. And let's just say that presentation is not fully completed yet, so... That I don't know. Some people, I feel like I hear a lot of hackers talk about how, like, they'll be going to this conference and they're like in their hotel room the night before prepping the slides and stuff like that. And I've never been that sort of guy. Like, I'm always the guy that like has it done way in advance, has it rehearsed, that sort of thing. But like, I felt like I should try it this time, and it is not working for me, dude.
No, that's stressful. I'm a procrastinator to some extent, but like for stuff like that, I wouldn't want to really be winging it.
You've got that ADHD brain where you can like procrastinate and then trigger like superpower mode, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't make the presentation good.
I don't know.
That's tricky for it.
Yeah, I suppose so. All right. What we got on the news for today? Let's see. Dude, this bcrypt thing is insane. Okay, yeah, so let me just give a little bit of let me just read this this release from that Okta put out. Okay, so it says, for Okta orgs without MFA sign-on policies and using accounts with usernames of 52 characters or more, this could allow users to authenticate by providing only the username and no password entered, or regardless of the password entered. What the heck, dude?
Yeah, so super interesting stuff. Somewhere, I guess, in the bcrypt spec, it says that it truncates inputs beyond, is it 72 characters or 72 bytes?
52 characters.
52 characters? Yeah, so it only takes, you know, up to a certain point, and then the rest of it gets truncated during, like, hashing, I guess. Jeez. They were concatenating username and password together and then hashing that in bcrypt. So if your username was too long, then it would just create a predictable hash that would never get changed by your password. And very, very...
Could you imagine? Like, this is one of those things, like, I want to say a couple of years back, there was like this scenario with Apple where you could just like press enter a couple times or something like that, and it would log you in as root. And
really?
I forget what it was called. Let me see. Apple, press enter root. It was something
with a blank password. Oh, this was in 2017.
Yeah, blank password. Yeah. Yeah.
Click
the
lock, type root in the username field.
And it was just
because root had no password. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I used to use this quite a bit, actually, back around that time as well, just for like logging. Like, I had like a secondary user account.
Yeah.
And I would use that. So it's really interesting.
It's just one of those things where it's like, you would never expect that to happen to Apple. And I personally would never expect this to happen to Okta, where it's like, there's just no, it just doesn't take a password. It's just like one of those brain fuck things that's like, what is going on here?
Yeah, for sure. It's very, very interesting bug. So it's, it's good that it got caught. How did they find it, or like how did it, like what?
I didn't see the way that they found it. Ideally, their bug bounty program would have caught something, but this is just one of those things that I think it for
me. Oh, it was discovered internally.
Like, oh, really? Discovered internally? Wow.
Yeah, well, and their timeline. So July 23rd, it was introduced. As part of a standard release, and then on October 30th it was discovered internally, and then they switched from bcrypt to pbkdf2.
Yeah, and actually it says down in the comments here that php.net even mentions that inputs above 72 characters get truncated. So you had 72 in your head, but they say 52 in the actual disclosure. So it's one of those two.
It could be that they have an additional pass. So like, you know, the speculation I think is that it was username password, but they right. probably have like a timestamp or some other thing in there. That's sure. like,
it's like 20 characters of padding.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But either way, very, very interesting.
Yeah. Definitely going to be on my radar because bcrypt I think is like something that you see from time to time when doing white box source code review. So if you see bcrypt at all, I'm just going to have it in my head like, okay, there's truncation happening here. How might I trigger that truncation? And I think if the username was an email in a lot of scenarios, this becomes a lot nastier, right? Like I feel like the length of that could be dramatically longer and result in this sort of truncation.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those things where I don't know how you would find it, I guess, from like, I would be kind of interested in how they found it. Like what caused them to find that?
I feel like somebody should have just found it, right? Like if somebody has a super long username and then they just like fat-fingered their password and it logged you in, like I would be like, the fuck? Like what is going on here?
I think more of it is like, you know, from like a security perspective, like you'd look at that code and you'd be like, okay, they're hashing it. Yep, looks good. Yeah. They run it through bcrypt. They call the standard bcrypt function. Okay, they compare it, blah, 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 whatever, right? But unless you know that like bcrypt has that quirk or that you've read into the spec that like bcrypt, like I don't think most security engineers would second guess like how bcrypt works.
Yeah, bcrypt, yeah.
Right. So it's very interesting. It's like a very, very bad edge case.
Yeah, that's not great functionality. I wonder, there's not really much. I mean, from an attacker's perspective, I think it's not super exploitable because, you know, the username has to be so long. So you can only attack victims with super long usernames or whatever.
Well, and it depends on like how it's being done. Yeah. Right. So like in this case, it's bad because it's username then password. Mm-hmm. If it was password then username, that'd be completely different.
True. True. But then, they wouldn't. That's a good point. So really, you have to see that. You have to see that same pattern where they're concatenating something that is a part of your a part of the account
that's like
identifier,
guessable or like knowable, like more than a password, or like
or static, non-privileged, like assault or whatever. That's
like an email. Like knowing the email, not a big deal. Knowing the email and password is a big deal.
Yeah,
knowing the email and being able to get it without a password, also a big deal.
Massive deal. Okay, solid. So I mean, a little bit of an edge case there, but definitely something to be considering if you're auditing the auth flows of these sort of environments where they're dealing with this crypt, like password hashing or using bcrypt. I've been diving a little bit deeper lately when I've been hacking stuff. I've been trying to look at least cursorily. I've been looking at least a little bit at like the implementation of crypto stuff and bugs keep on falling out, man. I had a bug yesterday where I could bypass the signing. Some signing that was being passed from the server side into the client side, and then the validation was being done in a JS library. I bypassed something there, and then let's just say at a live hacking event in the past 6 months, there was some crypto related bugs too. So I think I was scared of those for a long time, but I think if you understand some of the basic concepts and then you look a little bit deeper at the implementation, I think a lot of times those sort of issues kind of pop out.
Yeah, I think you'll find that most of the time it's not super home ruled.
Yeah.
Like sometimes it is, and that can lead to its own problems, but it's mostly just like in functionality, like how it's being used, or like they're generating this hash and then they're trusting it, and you know, maybe you can poison that hash or whatever. You know, it's more of like the fundamental principles more than it is like needing to be a math major to break SHA-256 or whatever. Yeah.
The one that I looked at the other day was there was a JWT token that was being passed, and it was hard coding. The way that they had written the code, it looked like it was hard coding the algorithm that it should be using to validate. It wasn't even using the header. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you look a little bit deeper into the code, it wasn't. It was trusting the algorithm that was in the JWT header. So you could just provide the none algorithm and it would still pass.
Interesting.
So a lot of libraries have that built in.
Super interesting.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump over to this next one. This is by ndevtk, and this is just a write-up of a bunch of Android specific Chrome behaviors and compatibilities and incompatibilities. I just thought this was super fascinating because I think there's a lot of attack vectors that I didn't really think about from an Android and Chrome perspective that he seems to be really aware of the threat model with. So I wanted to get your thoughts on all these, Joel. What do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people just sort of jump from like, you know, oh, you click a link and then it opens the app or whatever, but that has to happen from somewhere. And so there's a lot of like browser specific behavior, like Android out of the box ships with Chromium as like the Android web view. And then I think it probably, most of them ship with the Chrome app too.
Yeah.
Most people are probably using the Chrome app as well. And so there's a lot of like, you know, intent URLs. I'm pretty sure that is not like an implicit feature. It's like implemented specifically by Chrome and Chromium into the browser so that you can launch stuff with this intent schema. So there's like a lot of nuance to how that stuff works, the parameters, what's allowed, what's not allowed, what stuff you can launch, like how it gets parsed, all that kind of stuff. So this is a really good in-depth like look at that kind of stuff, as well as it seems there was a number of issues with like just the format of it, how it was being parsed and all that kind of stuff as well, like separate from how it's supposed to work. So very interesting stuff. They got quite a number of bounties.
I like here how they mentioned some of the attack vectors that I wouldn't really have known about without going through and reading like the Chromium issues. For example, apparently it's a problem that can be awarded $3,000, because that's what happened here. If you can force another browser to pop up from Chrome without a prompt. Apparently there's supposed to be some sort of prompt saying, hey, we're going to open this URL in Samsung browser. And the reason for that is because like if Samsung browser is running on a much older version of Chromium as a base, right? So if you can pivot from Chrome and force it to open up Samsung browser, then that makes it, you know, your chain there becomes a lot easier to do something like a browser end-day attack on that older version. Is that accurate? Right. Is that what you saw as well?
Well, I mean, like that's true. Generally speaking, you don't want to make it so that you can open other apps or like spawn intents from one app to another app, and especially not without that confirmation dialogue. So there's this like this concept of registered schemes, right? And so if, let's say you have two browsers on your device and they both register the HTTP scheme and you open a link, it should prompt you and say, do you want to open this in Chrome? Do you want to open this in Opera? Do you want to open this in whatever? And if it does it implicitly by like directly opening a specific app instead of prompting the user to do it, then that's, you know, obviously a vulnerability just like manifesting itself within the browser application, right? So it's awesome research, and definitely a lot of good snippets in here, just generally speaking about like the intent URL schema and like format and like how that stuff works and what stuff you can do with it, what like the parameters are, all that kind of stuff. So this is a really good
piece. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit, I think, on the mobile episode where we were talking about intent URLs and how all that works. But I think that is something that, like, if you want to level up as a mobile hacker, like, I think one of the next things on my docket as a mobile hacker would be, I need to understand how all of those work so that I can make my exploits more reliably, I guess, what would it be? Network?
I mean, you can raise network, the, right? You, yeah, be, I, like, you can raise the severity network of them, because, you know, even if it may be a more complex attack, you might be able to launch it from the browser instead of like having to rely on another app on the device. Right.
Right. That, so then it goes from like adjacent to like remotely exploitable, right? If they click a link in their browser.
Right.
So it still requires user interaction, but it's still, it allows you to access some of those like more intent, some more core Android exploitation techniques, if you understand how those work. That's pretty rad. Yeah, and I feel like there's a lot of crap that ships with Android devices and with like Samsung devices and stuff like that, like a lot of apps. And so I think there's probably a lot of more ripe attack surface than I actually gave it credit for, actually attacking like vanilla Android devices and say like, all right, let's grab all of these apps that come pre-installed and develop exploits that do things like, for example, opening up specific apps without a prompt.
Well, and you'll see that, like, you know, 9 times out of 10, when there is a vulnerability in like Samsung or something that's like not a kernel exploit, it is that. It's like there's a permissions issue in one of the system apps that's installed at a system level that has additional privileges, and you can escalate through that by doing something insecure through just like a standard Android mechanism.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm looking through some of these other ones, man, and there's like add to home screen spoof. There's like an iframe escape, and some of these haven't been fixed yet. It says asked and not fixed. Controlling Google Assistant asked and not fixed. The controlling Google Assistant one is actually kind of scary to me, man, because it looks like you can, you know, trigger the user to go to a deep link or whatever, and it will invoke specific routines or workflows inside of Google Assistant, which I would not want that to happen, right? Like I have some. Man, my OPSEC is so bad, dude. But I have some routines set up at my house that will do things with my home automation, right? And I'm like, I don't want people invoking that remotely. So I'm kind of confused about why this Google app :// deep link and then passing in this whole URL. I'm kind of confused as to why that wasn't fixed by Google.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it might be that. It's part of, I mean, you never know. Like, Google is not the kind of team that I generally am, like, worried that they're mishandling vulnerabilities. Yeah, so usually if they have, like, taken a stance on something, it's very, very specific for a valid reason. And, like, either they're working on fixing it or there's a threat model, like, or there's mitigating factors or whatever. I'm sure that there's some reason. You know, I don't think I've ever really seen an instance where the Google security team has like misvalued something or like not paid something properly. Well, there was that YouTube thing a little while ago, but it's pretty rare. I don't know if that was like, I don't know if that was necessarily like a mispayment per se, but they could have maybe paid higher.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I often see, like we talked about on the podcast, I think a couple weeks ago, or maybe I was just tweeting about it. I forget, but there was a vulnerability that was essentially a clickjacking that worked out and got paid, or an iframe injection. That's what it was. It was like an and then it got paid $15,000.
The Zendesk one?
Yeah. I want to, I don't know.
Was it Zendesk?
No. It's a different one. This is for Google. So it was a iframe injection. So you were able to control what site gets injected into an iframe. And then somehow he used it to get account takeover apparently, but $15,000.
Did you ever get clarity on?
Yeah. I think the result of that was very similar to like the person wasn't very explicit about it. I commented on that and they responded and said the result of that was something similar to that Google Drive one we saw a while back, where it's like you could embed, like there was like 15 client side chains. Yeah, it was kind of similar to that, where you could, you know, force share some Google Drive or like your root Google Drive folder. But I think he was able to get his to account takeover. So $15,000 sort of makes sense for that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you can figure out how to open arbitrary URLs within a Google product, that's usually like a really good foothold.
Yeah.
And probably one of the more common footholds you're going to like see, like, you know, because they have fairly strict like CSP and all like CSP evaluators written by Google. So
Yeah. So I'm looking through this whole thing. We'll link it down below. I would actually recommend any of the listeners that are trying to understand a little bit more about, I guess, intermediate to advanced, like mobile attack vectors. I think this write-up is really good, not only because it talks about some of these more fringe features like the intent URLs and that sort of thing, but, also because it talks about understanding the threat models of, these various apps and ecosystems, right? You know, I did not know that if you could bypass that little pop-up that says like, all right, we're going to open Samsung browser now, you know, press approve, that was going to result in a bounty. So understanding those threat models is one of the ways you can really stay on top of finding vulns in these sort of more complex environments.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what I'd say is, like, to that specific instance, just think about it like as if it's any other app, right? If you can open another app from PayPal, that's an issue. If you can open another app from Chrome, that's also an issue, like without user authorization, right?
Really? I didn't know that. So that little box that pops up from the bottom, is that what you're talking about, where it's like open with that? So if you can bypass that, that's a problem.
Yes.
Okay. Well, today I learned. Cool. Well, we'll link this NDevTK right up in the description, so check that out if you want some more details on that. Dude, another PortSwigger research drop. You see me? I'm rubbing the hands together, guys. I'm excited.
I wonder how much they're paying these guys.
Dude, they crank out some serious stuff, man. They really do.
James Kettle just hit like 10 years, right?
Yeah.
At PortSwigger. He was like, I love it here. I was like, dang, bro.
It's a good
model. I always hear these Europeans, wait, UK is not part of Europe. I always hear these people overseas on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean.
Exactly.
Talking about how they don't get these Bay Area engineering salaries, but somehow they managed to capture James Kettle and Gareth Hayes for so many years.
I feel like you gotta just write a blank check to Gareth Hayes and Kettle, man. Like, those guys.
Maybe that's
so
why they
valuable.
Raised money.
Yeah, maybe
they raised funding so they could pay their salaries.
Yeah. Seriously. This one was really cool though. It's titled "Concealing Payloads in URL Credentials," and I've got a couple comments on this. One, it's you guys know me and my client's love of client side stuff. So I see this and I just want to like give Gareth a hug because this stuff is so nice. But actually, it originated from Johan Carlson talking about how this sort of similar functionality on Twitter a while back. And it's not visible in the URL.
The functionality was in Twitter, or he was talking about it on Twitter?
No, he was talking about it on Twitter. Oh, and essentially what this is it's using the username and password parts of the URL, right? So you've got HTTP, HTTPS, right. colon slash slash, like, and then username colon password
app.
Yeah, exactly. So that. And you know, you can navigate to those URLs in Chrome, and it just won't show anything in the URL bar. And it won't show anything in window location.href, but it will show something in document.url. So this is another way that you can smuggle payload information into a page without like affecting the actual URL of the page or putting anything in the hash or giving the WAF anything to work with, because it's client side. So it was surprising to both Gareth and to me that location and document.url are different. And that, you know, definitely provides some ability to play around with this. And he pointed out really well that if that URL is actually being embedded into an A tag or something like that, and that A tag has an ID associated with it, then you can very easily access that value by using, you know, ID with like DOM clobbering like functionality, by using ID, in this case it was X, dot username or dot password, and that will return that string that you smuggled in.
So I have a suspicion as to why this is the case. And if you look kind of closely at it, document.url is a string. Right. So either it's crafted or it's set or whatever, you know, somewhere. Document.location and window.location is a location object. Right. So it's parsed. So because I was curious if there was like a username property on the location object or something, but it doesn't appear there is. But you'll notice that it's an object. It's a location object. It's not like document, and document.url is literally just a string. So I'm wondering, there might be other instances where that like exists as a proxy or something.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, like maybe there's another object that has a URL property on it or something that's nested somewhere else. So
window.location.href is also a string, but that href is...
Well,
does that, not,
that's going to come from the location object, right?
Yeah, it does. And it doesn't contain that username and password there either.
So my guess is that the location object constructor probably like parses it out specifically. It out. And then when you do .href, it basically like goes back. It like parses it and then turns it back into a string.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that Oh, just as a note, I'm just going to mention this before I forget. Safari does discard the URL. So this only works in Chrome and Firefox, which is crazy. Normally you see it the other way around, where Chrome does something and Safari's like, let me do
Safari is insecure. The new security champ.
Yeah. So I did want to mention a couple other things, you know, because we talked about last week how Safari has some weird cookie attribute commenting out functionality. This whole concept of smuggling data through and in such a way that the WAF cannot see it, I think is really valuable. And, you know, there's a lot of really unique payloads out there for XSS. But my favorite one, which is in line with this, is simply JavaScript colon name. Okay. That is a full XSS payload. And the reason for that is that you can assign the name value. That name attribute, window.name, persists across... It's not clobbering. It actually persists across window refreshes, right? So I open a window and I name it whatever I want. I can name it SVG onload alert 1, right? And then when I redirect to that JavaScript URL, JavaScript colon name, what it does is it returns from that JavaScript URL the name string, right? And then that name, the value of the name string gets considered to be the DOM of that page under the same origin that it came from. So if I put SVG onload alert 1 into the name and then redirect to that via JavaScript colon name, it will actually render the SVG tag on the page in pop alert. And there's no way that the WAF can see that.
Name is actually always exists. Yeah. It's a
persists.
It always exists. Mm-hmm. There's also, I mean, there's a lot of things that actually fall under this. So window.persistent all caps is a 1. It just holds the value 1. So if you did like JavaScript colon all caps persistent, that would alert persistent.
No. You could do there's lots of variables that are accessible, you know, at that capacity, but
can you just do like JavaScript colon 1? Does that work?
That'll put 1 on the page. Isn't that weird? Like that was what freaked me out one time, is I like did something that returned 1 or whatever, and then I saw it appear on the page and I'm like, what is going on here? And it's well documented. I thought for a second that I had found something weird here, but if you look at it, you know, JavaScript colon name is a pretty popular payload. You know, it's well documented, but it's just crazy to me that you don't have to do any assignment. You don't have to do anything like that, right? If you control the location that it's being directed to, you can just do JavaScript colon name and you don't have to do any function calls, anything like that. Because a lot of times the WAF block the backticks and they block the parentheses, right? So it makes it really hard to actually call functions. In this scenario, you can smuggle everything through window.name, which is something the WAF never even sees.
Yeah, and interestingly, because name is an empty string by default, you could concatenate to it with plus as well. So if you did like name plus 1, you would get 1 in a string.
Yeah.
So you could potentially pivot off of that as well.
Yeah, there's lots of cool quirks there. And then, so bringing this back around to the research that they were talking about with the URL stuff, this is another way to smuggle in data that the WAF never even sees, right? So you can smuggle in by a name, you can smuggle it in by a hash, or you can smuggle it in via this username and password functionality. And if that username and password gets embedded into an A tag, then you have a really easy way to access that with whatever ID dot username or dot password. So pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Super interesting.
All right. Now we got the monster, man. You ready? You ready for this guy? I don't know if I'm ready for this guy. This is a pretty intense one.
PHP strikes again.
Dude, we got to talk about it though. So there's this tool that got released this past week called Lightyear. And this is one of those things that, like, I feel like I should probably read through this and understand it fully. But when I read through it and I try to understand...
This is one of those things that I'm going to put a pin in it until I need it. next time I see a PHP page, I'm going to be like, oh, God damn it. Here we go.
Dude, that's a good... Thank you. That's what I'm doing too. That makes me feel a little bit better about this, right? But the TLDR of this, and I wanted to give it some publicity because, I mean, this is a shit ton of work and a shit ton of code that they had to write and intricacies that they had to understand to get us this tool. This tool allows you to abuse those PHP filter chains that we talked about on the pod a while back. And there's the current state of the art tool for that is, or prior to this one, was PHP filter chains Oracle exploit. And they outline in the beginning of this that there's a pretty big downside to this, which is that if your primitive is via a get parameter, right? So if you're injecting into an open or whatever, where you can use the PHP schemes, then if you're doing this via get parameter, then the size of that get parameter inflates pretty quickly if you're trying to get data out. So you can only get about 135 characters out before you start hitting the URI too long problem, right? And this tool, Lightyear, not only fixes that, it can dump files of tens of thousands of bytes with just small payloads, a couple thousand characters. But it also does it a lot faster and does it more efficiently and doesn't produce any PHP warnings or errors, which will sometimes break the whole flow. So I think...
You don't want that pesky IR team knowing what we're doing.
I know, exactly, right? So this is an awesome tool if you're able to actually inject into any of those sort of... functions that allow you to utilize those PHP schemes. For me, I don't do a lot of PHP hacking. So this is, I think I'm going to do exactly what you said, Joel. That makes so much sense to me. It's just, when next time I'm hacking PHP, next time I need this, I know exactly where to find this bookmark. But yeah, it's nice to know that they've got something that really allows you to read arbitrary files with that.
I think that's a really important part of learning, is like knowing when you should really learn something and when you should have it ready to be learned, you know, because there's a certain point. When I was young and invincible, I had infinite brain space. I am now old and no longer invincible and have limited brain space. And so I have to really pick and choose what I decide to keep.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I mean, I think that's absolutely necessary in this environment as well, in the IT environment, right? Particularly the security environment, where there's so much like onslaught of amazing research and stuff. You know, we're in this very small niche of bug bounty and I can't even keep up, right? Like, and it's my job to keep up, you know? Yeah. And so I think having these sort of categorized and knowing where to find them when you need them is important. So Lightyear is the new go-to tool for that. It seems like they've solved a lot of the problems. We can use small payloads. We can do it really fast. There's no errors or warnings. So that's a good one to have in your back pocket for sure. But Joel, did you see the little thing I added underneath this in the docs?
Oh, I didn't actually. That was the one link I didn't click.
No, dude. So it's like...
Oh, there's a... Wait, but this is old.
No, so I think they're going to implement it now, though. So
I see. They referenced this issue 4 days ago.
Yeah. So back in 2023, when this whole PHP filter chains research came out, someone was like, hey, we got to fix this in PHP. And they're like, nah. And then when this new research came out, they're like, all right, we got to fix this. So I think that at some point they're going to limit the number of filters that you can apply, which I think would kill a lot of this research. So
yeah, this guy, some guy mentioned this. I didn't know you could do this. This is one of those annoying things about GitHub that you can like, there's always like ways to like make yourself appear on things.
Yeah.
And so I guess he mentioned this issue on his own repo in a commit and it like, populated, but some guy has added like a limit to the number of filters into the PHP, into a fork of the PHP source. So
we'll see if it actually gets pulled in or not. But
if you want to do that yourself, you can, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a PR. I'm stupid.
Yeah, it's a PR. So I think it should be.
Yeah, so somebody opened a PR. Yeah. Chaining filters are becoming increasingly popular primitive to exploit PHP applications, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, it still has to be accepted.
It's just going to be a configurable option, right? Like, there's plenty of dangerous things that are in PHP that you have to enable as a configuration option.
Yeah.
Even though that's a lot of people do turn these things on. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be, you know, somebody's going to be like, oh, number of filters -1 or whatever. Like, and just then totally you'll have the same problem. But for now, at least it'll be like, you know, secure by default, which is good.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Alrighty, Richard, what's on the docket for today? Oh, an ASMR ad? Say less. I got you. All right, guys. So today we're going to... attack surface management roles, not AS. Okay, I got you. Well, if we're talking about attack surface management, then of course we're talking about the AcidNote team, right? The OGs in the ASM space. And this time around, they've released a new community project, their attack surface management job board, a place where you can see all of the companies that are hiring for attack surface management jobs. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, if you're a recon heavy hacker, or if you just want to get your hands on the AcidNote product to play around with it, then definitely check out that job board. That's going to be at acidnote.io/ASMR. I'm going to make them change it to ASMR. So if you want to support the pod, or if you want to check out that job board, head over to acidnote.io/ASMR. All right, back to the show. Let's go. Okay, so moving on to this next one. There's a release from Yes We Hack on a tool called DOM Explorer. And its architect, of course, is our boy BitK. And I just got to say, man, I think I've been sleeping on Yes We Hack a little bit. Like, I think Yes We Hack is actually putting out some really solid stuff, a lot of which is coming from BitK.
It's a shame I'm not wearing my Yes We Hack hat right now.
I know, dude. We got to go get our swag, because the swag they sent out was really, really high quality too. But it seems like they're actually dumping a lot of really cool toys for hackers, right? Because we mentioned before they've got that that XSS exploitation framework, right? Where that makes it really easy to exploit XSS and exfil information. And it's got a bunch of sort of modulized exploitation vectors. Okay, I'm sorry. Hold on. Joel, I have something.
Modulized.
Something like that. But I'm actually going to just totally deviate from this really quickly, because I wanted to mention something that I did the other day that I thought was really cool. Okay?
Okay.
So on the concept of XSS exploitation, I was in this scenario. All right, come story time with Justin. Let's go.
Okay.
I was in this scenario, right, where I had a page that was triggering a redirect and then writing my data to the DOM, right, via inner HTML. So it shouldn't trigger, right? Because the redirect would delete the DOM, you know, before it actually writes to the DOM. And it's one of those things where you're like, you're redirecting, but then if it's too slow, we'll let you click this button, right? That does like a redirect, right? And I had the injection into this button. And so here's what I did. I just wanted to put this on y'all's radar. The host that I was redirecting to, that the page was redirecting to, was controllable by me to a certain degree, but it had to be whitelisted, right? So what I did is, the domains were whitelisted, but the port was not whitelisted. So what I did is I got a valid domain, and I put, you know, semicolon 1337. So now it's redirecting to a page that doesn't have an open port on it, right? So it's trying to set up that TCP connection, and it's retrying and it's retrying and it's waiting. And it doesn't remove the DOM of that page until it opens that TCP connection with the next page. The navigation doesn't actually occur, right? So that allowed the delay to be long enough for it to write my payload to the DOM. All right, but that's not the end of it, Joel. Listen to this, okay? So now I've got my payload written to the DOM, but there's a WAF. There's a WAF, dude. And so what do I do? I'm like, okay, of course, I just use like location name, you know, just like we talked about earlier.
You send like 80,000 A's.
Yeah, there's like, well, that could work too. But classic move. But the WAF was really getting in the way, and it was blocking any function call, and I can't use location because there's already a location change in progress, right? So it wouldn't let me override that. So here's what I did, dude. I didn't actually get the full exploit to work. What I did was I set window.name equal to document.cookie, right? So now I've set name equal to cookie, and name persists refreshes, right? So then from my attacker control tab, because I opened this tab where the exploit is happening, I can control where that tab goes. So then I redirect it back to an attacker controlled origin. I reach into that DOM and read the name property, and I can leak the cookies on that page.
So using it as like a holder.
Yeah. So it's like a way to steal information out of those sort of environments without actually executing any functions, because it's just name equals document.cookie.
Yeah, I'll see you in 3 months when Chrome patches that, dude.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know,
isolate the name variable.
It's a pretty niche scenario. But I just thought I'd mention it as well, because I think there are a lot of scenarios where WAFs are kind of a pain in the ass to bypass when you're dealing with execution. You're actually getting JS execution, but you can't trigger function calls. And so having some way to smuggle data back out via the window.name, I think could be a pretty useful technique for people.
Yeah, for sure.
So, okay. So the reason I went on that was that XSS tools thing, which was triggered by DOM Explorer. So now we're going to talk about DOM Explorer. Are you still with me, Joel?
I'm DOM Explorer, inspired by Cyber Chef, but looks nothing like it.
Oh my gosh, dude. I'm sorry. I had to rant there for a second. All right. So, DOM Explorer. I guess this one's mine too, because I'm the DOM geek. You want me to talk about this one?
I mean, it's so basically I feel like I saw like a screenshot of something that was very similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was during the DOM Purify by XSS like a couple months ago.
Yeah. I
don't remember if
Matthias
it was like
Carlson has something, doesn't he?
Yeah. I think somebody had scrapped together something very simple where you basically just put an input in and then it would like you click a button and it just runs it through DOM Purify and see the output.
Yeah.
So that's basically what this is, right? Where you have this DOM Explorer tool and you can create a pipeline of, you know, that's where it's very much so like Cyber Chef, where you have like steps that you can run an input through. And so you can say, okay, I want to run it through DOM Purify, or I want to run it through this parser or whatever, or the sanitizer, et cetera. And you can have this pipeline of steps that your input goes through. And then you can inspect what the output would be after all of those different pipeline steps. And so that can be really, really helpful when you're, you know, trying to exploit an XSS in some specific environment. You know, it's going through X, Y, and Z sanitizer and renderer and a parser and whatever. And you just want to really quickly, rapidly test inputs, see what stuff you can get through. Instead of sending request, wait 3 seconds, request, wait 3 seconds, you can build out that pipeline on the DOM Explorer and test your inputs. And then when you're pretty sure you know, have a bypass, you can actually go test it.
Yeah. And I think this is helpful for looking at those sort of scenarios where you've got a stack on a open source software that you want to pwn, and it's like, okay, it's using like DOM Purify, and then it's putting it into this, and then, or maybe it's putting into this like HTML renderer on the server side, and then, you know, it's exporting as a PDF or something like that. And you can chain together these pieces and see how they interact together. And yeah, I did find that thing you mentioned, dude. It's of Lee Dinbrun, it's Matthias Carlson. It's a tool called Multi HTML Parse, and I'll add this to the docs as well, so it gets put in the notes. But I think as many of these as we can get, the better, because there's so many different frameworks for parsing HTML and rendering stuff. So I think that's really good. The one thing I like about DOM Explorer, which is the one by SVHack that we're talking about right now, is that it's actually in the browser. So and it's set up and you don't have to do like Docker or anything. It's just like go to yeswehack.github.io/dom-explorer. And it will give you this interface where you can play with it. And you can add a ton of different parsers. So DOM parser, parse5, DOM purify, JS XSS, all sorts of stuff. And so, you know, if it isn't in this tool, DOM Explorer, then, you know, it might be in multi HTML parse or vice versa. And I think as we sort of build these tools up, it becomes a lot easier to find mutation XSS, right? Where different parsers are treating things differently and trigger those more universal XSS scenarios where you're bypassing some whitelists that are like absolutely pivotal to security.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's like lots of configuration options as well on DOM Explorer. So like, for example, like DOM parser, it has, you know, what's the MIME type that you're feeding into it? Does it have a doc type? What selector are you feeding it? What's the output for? Like, and so you can, you know, you can really get sort of pretty narrow down on it, and you can make it very, very accurate to what you're testing against so that it works very, very well and it's good for testing.
Yeah. Very solid, dude. Yeah. Yeah. So definitely,
super cool.
I'm going to keep an eye on the Yes We Hack GitHub stuff, because they, especially, you know, what BitKey's been releasing lately has really been kind of putting them on the map for me, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Super, super cool tool. This is another one of the ones, like everything else, I bookmark it, put it in my,
yeah,
my tools list, and then I don't think XSS. About it again. I don't think about it until I need it.
All right, what we got next here?
This last one?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me see.
Yeah, JSON. Okay, I had a bone to pick with this.
Okay, all right. Well, okay, so I put this in here because I'm like, you know, I feel like JSON is something that we deal with a lot, right? We're the listeners don't have context to the docs. I put a link in here that essentially allows you to visualize JSON a little bit easier. And the thought was this. Is there a place for JSON visualization progress in our HTTP proxy tools? Because 90% of the time we're dealing with JSON, right? The request bodies are request JSON. And I feel like, you know, we spend a decent amount of time modifying attributes and like moving things around and that sort of thing. And I wonder if it would be better to have some sort of visualizer inside of the HTTP proxies that makes it easier to work with JSON. What do you think about that?
I think the only thing I would like to see is JQ searching. That's it.
What is JQ searching? JQ, you know, like searching?
JQ format searching. So like being able to filter by attributes using a JQ query and just like put that in a search box. I know you can do it in PAW, now Rapid API, but like the PAW like API tool. It's kind of like Postman, Insomnia, you know, whatever you choose to use. But yeah, it has a thing in like the response format where you can filter down, you know, whatever your response is, which is like a query like that. And so you can do, you know, like dot attribute or whatever, and you'll only see that in your output. So I think that would be really nice. Yeah. You know, this is it's an interesting tool, right? So this JSON crack thing, it's like a JSON editor. It's like visualizes JSON graphs, but
yeah, and I feel like my JSON crack wasn't necessarily the thing that I was trying to like talk about. Like JSON, we can talk about JSON crack, but the concept more that I was thinking of is like, do we need this? Like, would it make our life? No, is the answer to that no?
No, because this takes JSON and tries to make it into something that it's not, right? Like, it's like, let's take JSON and make it like a structured, defined, typed, like. Property, like, it's like that exists. It's called XML.
Oh, geez. Yeah, no, and we don't want to go closer to XML for sure. Yeah, you know, okay, maybe I'm off base with that. I just think, you know, it's worth challenging the status quo on these sort of things, right? Like, I feel like there should be easier ways to modify the things that we need to modify in the request body. And actually, I've got a solution for that I'm going to be releasing in a couple of weeks. It's not specifically for that, but it can do this as well. So we'll see when I'll talk about that when that episode goes live, and we'll see if we still need to address these sort of the sort of way that we interact with these various content types. I do want to say as well, and I told this to the Kaito team, and I think this is something that is in the pipeline, but I feel like both Burp and Kaito should automatically just change the content type based off of what format you have in the request body. Does that not make sense? Like, I mean, sure, it should be a checkbox, you know, where it's like, okay, you know, do you want us to automatically update the content type like we update the content length? But like, it's very easy to determine whether the request body is JSON, XForm URL encoded, or multipart.
Yeah, I will say like one of the more annoying things in recent Burp updates, recent, I don't know, within the last like 2 years, is the JSON like auto formatting. That thing drives me crazy when I'm typing in the request, and like I'll put like a quote and then it like adds a new line because it's trying to format it, and then I put another quote and then it like brings it back because it's closed the string.
It's hard, man. Like, JSON formatting, I think, is a really challenging piece. So that's why I'm kind of wondering is like, is there a better way to approach this?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the visual editor could be like a nice touch. I just think it kind of overcomplicates things. And then like,
I want to say there was an interface in Burp at one point where they were like, where you could switch the way that the request bodies were represented, and then it would give you like a text box on the left-hand side and a text box on the right-hand side. Yes. And like, Did you ever see that, or am I hallucinating?
That's how I use my burp. Is that not how you use burp?
What?
That's how mine looks. Is that not what your burp looks like?
Wait, no, no, no. When you're when you're manually modifying the request body.
Yeah. You don't have to.
maybe I just need to. To be fair, I haven't opened burp in a long time, but yeah, I think that's nice for XForm URL encoded, but I don't you know, I feel like something like that for JSON could be really helpful as well. I don't know, just a thought.
Yeah, I know Hackverter does that too with like previews. Oh, so cool. Like you can do like a Hackverter preview in the like replay tab and stuff, and it has like a left like a input output thing and all that.
That's pretty rad. I think that'd be good. So, dude, okay. Let me see if I got permission to talk about the thing that I was going to talk about. Yes, I did. Okay. They messaged me back in time. Sweet. All right. So let me just tack this on at the end here of the podcast. And I'll probably talk about it at a different podcast as well. But, you know, a while ago, you and I talked about on the pod about somebody needs to build a freaking notes plugin for Kaido and for Burp that is good, right? That has markdown rendering. That I found the guy, man. That guy is Static Flow Tanner, and it's good, man. I've seen it. He's been kind of working.
That's the guy I know.
Oh yeah, yeah, dude. He built out this tool, and it rocks. I've been playing with it, and it's really well structured. The markdown rendering is really clean. It supports exports. We're working on a sync feature where it'll sync to a specific part of the file system. I'm going to use it, man. That's where I'm going to write all my reports and all of my, notes. And I think that'll be the go-to methodology, because then you don't have to jump in and out of your proxy. You can just say, and he has it tied to a key binding as well. So I'm like, in my report, I click, whatever the key binding is. We just implemented that feature, so I haven't played with that yet. But jump into the key binding, and then you're in your notes, and you're type, and then... How do you like that? And then the type. So I'm excited for this. I'll link it in the description. Depending on when this episode airs, I'm not sure if it'll actually be live yet or not. But yeah, I think it will be. Definitely check that out. I think it'll be really. The Kaido one will be released by the time this episode comes out. I don't know that the Burp one will, but I know that he is working on a Burp version of this as well. And I think this is going to take over the notes market for the plugins.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because it's just kind of like, it's like your Evernote or your Obsidian, right? But it's just built into oh, here's the other feature, dude, that's crazy. You can link replay tabs in it. So you can say like, hey, this specific replay tab has...
Yeah, he showed me when he did that. He was like, yeah, check this out. And it's like links it, and you just click it, and just like opens the tab.
Dude, it's so good. Why haven't we had that? I don't know. But
Because Burp is swing-based.
Yeah, well, that's what he said. He's like, it's so much harder to code this in Burp. Because
it's so hard in Burp.
It's a pain in the ass, but... Yeah, Kaido, I think because it's just, JavaScript and HTML, there's a lot of libraries, you can use for that. So makes it much easier to dev there.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, man. Cool. Is that a wrap? Is that the pod?
I think that's it.
All right. Peace.
Peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.